everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2024, and this is episode 397, which is a conversation about having an eternal perspective and preparing for death. Now, I don't want anyone young, unless you're less than 20 years old, to turn off this podcast, because all of these issues apply to every season of life, because we don't know when we're going to die and we need to prepare for them, even if you're in your 20s. So this is a really important conversation. Today's guest is Elizabeth Reynolds Turnage. She is an author, Bible teacher, and life and legacy coach. Elizabeth offers workshops to help people gather all the essential documents for end of life and to help them prepare a practical and spiritual legacy. Elizabeth has written an online feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and her article is called Understanding Medicalized Dying and Preparing for Incapacitation or Death. You can read her article for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. None of our articles and content is under a paywall, so head on over to equip.org to read her article. Elizabeth, it's good to have you back on the podcast.
Thanks, Melanie. Great to be back.
Well, this is the second in a series of three articles in 2024 that Elizabeth is writing for us about these issues of end of life as Christians think about what it means to grow physically older in age, and also what it means to prepare, you know, a spiritual legacy and go through practical preparations. So some of these issues we're going to talk about today, because we're going to talk about medicalized dying. So I think it's, you know, really something that's of interest to all people, not people that are actually getting older in age and planning ahead, but also, you know, for people who are adult children, because some of these issues overlap when our parents need to make some of these particular decisions and need to face some of these things. So that's what we're going to talk about, some of these biblical principles and some of the types of things that happen at end of life sometimes don't even happen with age. So that I want everyone to continue to tune in, because I don't want you to think, oh, this is only for people who are older or have older parents. Well, it's true that that seems more like an immediate need. This is also some issues that impact all kinds of other folks too. So first of all, let's just start with some definitions. So Elizabeth, what is medicalized dying?
Yeah, it's kind of a phrase that has come into our culture as a result of all of the medical advances after post-World War II that allowed people to live longer and you know, is really a wonderful thing. Things like antibiotics, surgery, chemotherapy, modern medicine has made things possible and has made it possible for all of us to live longer. But because of these medical advances, doctors and theologians began to talk about this phrase, medicalized dying. And one theologian said, in medicalized dying, death is seen as an enemy to be defeated by the great powers of science and medicine. And so in some ways, some of the medical advances have taken away this fact that it's a reality that we all die, and that sometimes some of the aggressive measures at the end of life really are not so much sustaining life as they are prolonging death. And when I say that, we're talking about some things like some of the life-sustaining measures like CPR or dialysis or ventilators or artificial nutrition, things like that. And even more, you know, every day there are new ways and new things that are invented to sort of at times prolong death when somebody is already dying. And so as Christians, and I'm so glad you said that, Melanie, about whatever your age, please, please tune into this because this is important for all of us to know about. I mean, sadly, we've all known that person who, you know, maybe a young person who was in a very severe accident and is in a coma, and then decisions have to be made. And so as Christians, really, we want to be educating ourselves about these means from a very young age so that we can think about them biblically and think about what it means to glorify God in our bodies, in all of our lives.
Well, this is kind of tangential to our conversation today, but somewhat related. Back 50 episodes ago, in episode 347, I want our listeners to also, if you're interested in the subject, listen to our podcast called Murder by Medicine in Canada and the Threat to America. And it does talk about secular trends, medical trends, in terms of assisted suicide. So you're going to want to listen to that. But some of these issues we're going to talk about are not along those lines, although those are adjacent. It's just like, how do we respond to this? Like exactly what you were saying, because sometimes we don't even think about it until we're faced with it. In other words, we have a loved one that is facing a terminal disease of some kind, and there's more pain than there is relief. What do we do there? And again, like we said, it could be an older parent, but it also could be a child with cancer or something else that happened. Like you just mentioned, a person in the prime of their life, one of your children has a severe accident, something happens. And so these kind of issues are suddenly at the fore. So the time to think about them is when you're not facing them imminently. So how do Christians really respond to medicalized dying? Because again, we don't really think about it unless suddenly our personal circumstances dramatically change, and now here we are faced with the issue.
Right. And you're so wise, Melanie. And again, that is just so important for our viewers to hear, that the more we can think about these things and pray about these things and educate ourselves about these things when we are not in crisis, that is the best way to prepare and to have a response when crisis comes. You know, it's interesting that studies have shown that Christians are more likely to choose aggressive medical measures at the end of life than non-Christians. And those are secular studies that have been done. So what is this about? There's a physician named Dr. L.S. Dugdale, and she wrote a book called The Lost Art of Dying, and she writes about this. And she in that book, she told a story about a patient, and he was an 88-year-old man. He had late-stage cancer. He was emaciated. He was clearly dying. His cancer has spread to his bones and to his brain. And so his breathing stopped. They called a code. The whole team of medical personnel rushed in. They did all they could, and they restored his breathing. But in order to do so, they had to insert a breathing tube, which is a very invasive and also uncomfortable thing. He had to be placed on a ventilator. He was moved to the ICU. And she said in the book, she said, you know, the medical team really felt almost kind of discouraged after saving this man's life, because they knew that it was only a matter of time before this happened again. And so she was the attending physician, and she spoke with the daughter, and she said, would you like to have a do not resuscitate order put in place so he would not have to endure this physical trauma again of being resuscitated? And she refused, because she said that she was a Christian and she believed that God was going to work a miracle. And Dr. Dugdale wrote, it seems curious that the people who believe most fervently in divine healing cling most doggedly to the technology of mortals. So it's really something for us to think about, and why I'm so glad that we're doing this podcast and that we have this series of articles to think about how we want to think about the end of life as Christians and how we want to think about God's providential care, and also the fact that God numbers our days and to trust him with the number of those days, but also to think practically about when we are just prolonging death rather than sustaining life.
Even after almost 400 episodes in 8 years, there's still so much to cover in the world of Christian apologetics, cultural apologetics, and Christian living and theology. And we want to continue to bring all of this free content to you every week. So the best way you can help us grow this podcast is to simply get the word out. Tell a friend or share your favorite episode or episodes on your social media accounts, or even text your favorite episodes, a link for those, to friends or family members or people at your church, because we have really covered quite the gamut of subjects over the past 8 years. And really, another way that you can help us is to simply give us a rating or review. Seems like the best place to do that is at Apple Podcasts, although you can drop a review wherever you get your podcasts. But if you go on there and leave us a starred review, that's the quickest. But if you have a moment to think of one sentence about why you want to share with others that they should listen to the podcast, your one sentence elevator pitch, we would be so grateful if you attach that to a comment, because that's the way people can find out about this podcast. And we have all kinds of interesting subjects planned for you for the rest of 2024. And we're halfway done right now. This is the second installment in terms of thinking of end of life and how to prepare and how to live well as a Christian as you get older. And so Elizabeth will be back one more time towards the end of the year to complete this series. But this is a very important topic, and I hope that you're listening, even if you're young, because a lot of times I've lived long enough that you don't expect someone to die, for example, in their 20s, and yet they do and they pass away. And so what kind of plans have you made for your legacy, for letting, you know, people who are close to you know what your wishes are? So I hope you enjoy the rest of this podcast. Thank you for helping us in so many ways. And if you feel like it, please give us a tip. Just head on over to equip.org. If you go to journal and then click on Postmodern Realities, any one of the landing pages, including this one and all the previous 396 episodes, has a link where you could give us a tip, like $3, $5, $10, maybe skip that lunch out or your favorite artisan coffee or drink, and give us a tip so we can continue bringing this content. But we want to thank you. We want to thank you for listening. We want to thank you for telling other people about us. And now back to my conversation with Elizabeth Turnage. Well, it is almost a nuanced thing, because on one hand, secular medicine doesn't value human life in the same way that a Christian worldview does, when so many people who do not have a Christian worldview see, you know, humans as animals like any other animal. So there's not a value for human life. But at the same time, there is ethics that we have to think through all these end of life issues. So it is a nuance between people who believe that, you know, what does it matter? Human life is expendable, right? On one hand. And also on the other hand, what you're saying is, how do we die well? How do we have hope in Christ, knowing that this temporal world as Christians that we're journeying through is not the end for us? So what are some of the kinds of aggressive measures that are done at end of life that we need to know more about? And actually, in preparation for this podcast, I was talking to a colleague who had become a young widow and asked him about it, because there were issues that he had to face as his wife was dying. How do you balance someone's extreme pain when the doctors have told you we cannot give them any other relief at all? This is it. And, you know, can they go through one more round of chemo? Can they go through one more procedure? So why don't you walk us through some of those things? Because it, like in his case, as a young widower, it becomes all too real. And you weren't thinking that you had to think about it for many decades.
Yeah. And, you know, that in that kind of situation, you know, it's so important. And I hope that that his medical team, that her medical team that was advising both of them, led them to hospice care. That's another thing that sadly doctors are a little bit late in talking about for whatever reason. I don't know if it's the sense that they perceive that the family will perceive that they have given up in some way, but there does come a point in a terminal cancer diagnosis and in other diagnoses where you really want to know about hospice care, which is care for when it is care that Medicare pays for when doctors say that they would not be surprised if the person died in the next 6 months. And so now that does not mean that if the person lives on past six more months, that they can't, that hospice care can be renewed. But hospice care provides a whole, you know, realm of social workers, chaplains, all a whole medical team to help the person navigate the end of life and have comfort, have, you know, palliative care, have pain, comfort for pain and that sort of thing. So that would be kind of the opposite of what we're talking about in terms of, so that's kind of comfort care at the end of life, which is a very helpful thing. Now let's talk about some of the aggressive measures that sometimes are chosen at the end of life that maybe are not helpful when a person has 6 months or less to live. Things like CPR. So we go back to the example that Dr. Dugdale talked about. Sadly, too many of us have learned most of what we've learned about these aggressive measures through television or movies. So let's take television or movie CPR. If we were watching TV and this, here's what would happen. The bedside monitor would show that the heart has stopped, and then they call the code. It's very dramatic. And all these people rush in, and someone always yells clear on TV, and the heart is shocked and the heart rhythm returns. By the end of the episode, the patient is well and leaves the hospital. So that's, you know, kind of maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but that's really often what we see on TV. Here's the reality about CPR that people often don't know. Ribs are fractured, blood is spilled, the patient is always placed on a ventilator and moved to ICU, and only 10% of hospital patients recover after CPR. So you can see that there's quite a dichotomy between what is portrayed on TV and what actually happens. Now, that doesn't mean that we should never allow for CPR to be given to someone we love. It does mean that a person who is dying or near the end of life or has a terminal illness should pray with their care team, with their loved ones, about whether or not to have a do not resuscitate order in place to say, no, I don't want, if my heart stops, don't do that to me because that means the Lord is calling me home. Some other end of life measures that we want to learn more about are ventilators, which support breathing when there is respiratory failure, but that they are invasive. They involve this tube being placed, and it is very, according to patients, very uncomfortable. Dialysis, which replaces kidney function. And again, dialysis can be a great thing for a person who is not at the end of life. Artificially administered nutrition, which is delivered through tubes in the gastrointestinal tract. These can be uncomfortable. And if a person is dying, they may not be something that the patient would want to choose. So again, the real issue, Melanie, is thinking, is this sustaining life good thing? Is it prolonging death? Not necessarily a good thing. Sometimes, you know, maybe somebody wants to live for a week to see their grandchild graduate from college and, you know, either on live stream or even in person. And then it might be a time to choose one of these measures. So again, it's all, you know, with prayer and with wise counsel that we would want to consider these aggressive end-of-life measures.
Just so our listeners know, sometimes if you are in the hospital, they might use the acronym DNR. And so that what they mean is, did you fill out a DNR? Did you fill out a do not resuscitate? And the reason why, you know, I'm hoping everyone continues to stick with this episode is because sometimes, you know, you really need to think through it together, as you were saying, with a team, because even if everyone's a Christian, one person may have a different view than another person. What if the elderly parent or grandparent said, I do not want to be resuscitated, but their child says, no, I don't agree with that. I don't know, we're going to get into all the, you know, all of these things, but they're the medical power of attorney. Now, what does the child do? Because they would want their parent to be resuscitated, but the parent doesn't want to be resuscitated. So this is why you really need to wrestle with all of these issues before you're in a crisis situation when two people may have a different view. That would include spouses. What if one spouse says, yes, I want to do a DNR, and the other person says no? So all of these things really need some wise counsel and much prayer. So given that, what are biblical principles that Christians need to apply when choosing, you know, what kind of end-of-life measures to receive or to not receive?
Yeah, this is, before I answer that about the biblical principles, Melanie, I do want to speak to something you just said. It is so true. And we'll talk a little bit later just practically about an advanced directive or a living will, depending on what your state calls it. But one of the things that you reminded me of that I run with a social worker who has worked in hospice and palliative care. We run a course called Organizing Your Life and Legacy. And one of the things that we tell people over and over and over again is that communication is key. And so it is very important not only to think about what your wishes for the end of life are, but to communicate them to your family and to make sure when we'll talk about this a little bit later, the healthcare power of attorney or healthcare proxy, whatever your state calls that, that they're on board, that they are going to execute your wishes. So we'll talk a little bit more about advanced directives, but I just wanted to highlight what you said and point out the communication, you know, understand, learn about these things and communicate. It's hard to have conversations with your family. There's a great website called The Conversation Project, and they have some great videos. Some are very humorous about how to get started in having these conversations. So just wanted to mention that. So back to your question.
And one thing I wanted to say before you answer that question is that sometimes it's not just between two individuals. Sometimes if it's, let's say, three or four siblings, but one sibling has medical power of attorney, and then the parent, that person has a different view than the parent, and then the other siblings agree with the parent. Now you have the person with the medical attorney, you know, quote unquote, not agreeing with the rest of the family. So you really need to communicate with other siblings or anybody else involved in that circle, because sometimes it's not just you and your spouse, but you and other people, your spouse's brothers and sisters who may not agree with what's going on, and it can cause tension. So as Christians, as we want to be people who do pursue peace, we have to make sure that our communication is clear.
Yes. And that it is an issue. Like you say, you know, people think, oh, well, I'm a Christian, why do I need an advanced directive? Well, because this is about pursuing peace and loving our neighbor. That is our family. And it is why, you know, you want to communicate, and your healthcare power of attorney or healthcare proxy is agreeing to support you. So that's another thing that we want to talk a little bit about is, just making sure that you're, you know, that you communicate and that you're you choose a healthcare power of attorney that is on board. Whether or not they like it, they are going to execute your wishes. So, and as you say, when you get all these siblings involved, if you have communicated to all of your family in advance, not just your healthcare power of attorney, but all of them in advance, what your wishes are and why you have these wishes, you know, and you can say, you can disagree with me, but I am going to be with Jesus. And so this is what I want. And this is how I would like you to honor my wishes. And so very, very important. And back to your question about biblical principles, this is where you can bring those into the conversation to support your reasons for the decisions you're making. So I am really just borrowing what I say about biblical principles from a wonderful book, also written by another Christian. It's interesting, several Christian female physicians have written these wonderful books about some of these topics. Dr. Catherine Butler was a critical care surgeon, and she has written the book Between Life and Death, A Gospel-Centered Guide to End-of-Life Medical Care. So she talks about four biblical principles. And the first you mentioned earlier, Melanie, sanctity of life. So of course, the Lord God created male and female in his image. And because of that, every human being has dignity and has the life is full of dignity and worth and holiness. And so that is a very important principle to start with. The second is, and this is so important to remember, you know, back to that woman who said, well, God's going to work a miracle for her 88-year-old dying, suffering father. God has authority over life and death. And so, you know, if God rules over the life and death of something like a little sparrow, which we're told in Matthew 10:29 that he does, then he knows so much more than we do about when life and death end. And of course, as Christians, we know the death is not the end, but only the beginning of eternal life. She says in the book, sanctity of life does not refute the certainty of death. We are all going to die unless Jesus comes back before this podcast is over. We're going to die and we are going to go to heaven. So we need to accept that reality. The third biblical principle that she talks about is mercy and compassion. And she talks about having compassion for the person at the end of life. And she says that we want to bring comfort. I'm thinking about your friend who was a widower, and I hope that these are the kinds of conversations they had with him and his wife, to bring comfort without inflicting further suffering. And so we want to think about, what is compassion? What does mercy look like, particularly in a person who is suffering because of their disease and is dying? And the fourth is hope in Christ, because, and I kind of mentioned this a minute ago, but because Christ has defeated death, we have the hope of resurrection. And so we don't have to fear death, but we can look forward to going home to heaven. And that may be a reason that we say to our loved ones, back to this conversation about the advance directive, we may say, I don't want these end of life measures because I'm just in a hurry to get home to Jesus. And, you know, I'm sorry, family, that that's hard for you. I know you'll miss me, but I'm looking forward to being with Jesus and to ending this suffering of my disease whenever he chooses to take me. And that is the essential biblical principle to keep in mind, is that God rules over the number of our days, that it is really not our choice.
So I think one of the big questions for
family members and loved ones as you think through these issues are, what exactly is quality of life? So what are some quality of life issues that need to be taken into account when thinking about end-of-life measures to receive? Because like we were saying, when we have communication and we have people, there are so many that are close to us. There's so many people that, you know, we live in a broken world right now, and we don't want to see our loved ones not be with us here right now. And so sometimes would that actually influence us more than biblical principles based on what kind of quality of life our loved one's going to have one more procedure, to have one more invasive thing done, those kinds of things. So can you speak to that? Like, what are the things that we need to take into account? Because these are hard issues.
They are. And of course, when it gets to quality of life, that's very individualized, but there are some big issues that sometimes, again, one of them is very practical. Some of them are very practical, and we just don't think of them until that crisis comes. So one of the big quality of life issues that we should consider in advance is hospital or home. Do we want to be in the hospital when we die? There was a study done by the Kaiser Family Foundation that showed that 71% of people said that they would prefer to die at home. Well, considering that statistic, so often people do actually end up dying in the hospital. And part of the reason for that is some of these end-of-life measures that we've already discussed today would require people being in the hospital. And so knowing, well, if I say, I want to be put on a ventilator, that's going to require me to be in the hospital. If I say that I will allow dialysis when I'm dying, then that's going to require me going to the dialysis center. So just on a very practical level, deciding, do I want to be in a hospital or in a home when I die? And understanding that sometimes in hospitals, it will mean more isolation. Fewer visitors are able to come and be with a patient when the patient is in the hospital, particularly if they are in the ICU, as they would be after a do not resuscitate. If CPR is performed, that's going to put the person in ICU at least for a period of time. So knowing that, just recognizing if you say, I'd rather be at home, then recognize that may mean saying no to some end-of-life measures. Another big one that is really interesting for Americans is financial considerations. Americans really seem to struggle to accept this reality. According to Dr. Bill Davis, who wrote the book Departing in Peace, he wrote about a biblical decision-making and the end of life, and he talked about the cost of some treatments are prohibitive. He gave an example of a woman who had been treated for breast cancer, and she had survived breast cancer. She had had chemotherapy for that. And then several years later, she was diagnosed with late-stage pancreatic cancer. The doctor said, well, you've got 5 months to live, but we do have this one experimental treatment. And this experimental treatment could add 2 months to your life. And then they told her the cost, and it was very, very expensive, and insurance wouldn't pay for it because it was experimental. And she didn't want to spend her children's inheritance on something that was only going to give her 2 months more of life. And yet people in her church, Christians, were saying, oh, but you have to choose this treatment because it will give you longer to live. And so Dr. Davis was able to talk with her, and he encouraged her, according to a biblical principle of financial stewardship, and using all of our talents and opportunities and resources to glorify God. And he said, earthly life is not the highest good. And that is important to remember. Even when we talk about sanctity of life, earthly life is not the highest good. And he said, you could reasonably decline choosing this chemotherapy because of its cost and because, you know, cost benefit analysis, it really wasn't going to give her that great of a benefit. And it was also going to reduce her quality of life, her ability to enjoy her family and let them enjoy her in her final months of life. So that was very helpful. He does that in that book. He gives a lot of different stories, different examples of ways to think about some of these principles. So we definitely want to consider financial costs, because sometimes we are offered these types of treatments that are very expensive. This same thing happened with my father. He was given an oral chemotherapy pill, and it was very costly, and insurance paid for it. And then that pill stopped working, and there was another one that they offered him, and he knew that he was near the end, and he just said no. And his doctor was very helpful. It's not that often that an oncologist will say, no, I really wouldn't do it if I were you in your situation. And so that gave him the freedom to not choose that very costly treatment that wasn't going to add very much time or benefit to his life. And then the last thing that is a really important thing to consider, and for some reason, we as Christians don't think of this first, but the spiritual quality of life. So to ask the question, will this allow me to take in the ordinary means of grace, prayer, fellowship, communion, meditating on God's word? So how will this option allow me to continue to enjoy God and glorify God? Our two questions that we often ask from the catechism. So those are just a few of the quality of life issues that we might want to consider.
So let's talk about, you know, what are the kind of things we should do to prepare for the end of life, now that people probably understand some more of the issues involved with medicalized dying. Is there ways that we can prepare and not be caught off guard if there's a sudden crisis?
Yes. So the very important, essential, I would love to see people finish listening to this podcast and then go download an advanced directive from the Conversation Project or from Five Wishes, or you can go to one of your hospital or your state, just search by your state and living will or advanced directive. Go ahead and download that and start filling it in. And what that does, it's called different things, but usually it's called either an advanced directive or a living will. And it helps to guide medical care in the case of incapacitation, or certainly in the case of a terminal illness. But it's, as we've already said multiple times, it is something that all of us should do now. When, you know, years ago, our 22-year-old son was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and I remember accompanying him to some of his doctor's appointments, and the nurse would always ask at every single appointment, do you have a living will? And some of us are asked that question. We actually should be asked that question at the doctor. And we want that answer to be yes. And what that does, that is a legal document that allows us to appoint a healthcare proxy or surrogate. You know, it's called different things in different states, but healthcare power of attorney, somebody who, that is the person that the medical team will go to say, what does she want in this case? She can no longer speak for herself. And what it does is it takes, if there is not one in place, then they're still going to go to the loved ones. But then the loved ones are not going to know the answer to the question. And so there is a great deal of fear and a great deal of indecision. And as you've already mentioned, there can be disagreement between different family members. And my friend that I run the course with, who's a social worker who's been at many bedsides in hospitals, has seen the arguments and just the pain that it has caused for people not to have an advance directive in place. So that's the first thing to do right now.
I know it's so hard for us to think about. It's easier to put it off, you know? But in addition to that, what are some other essential things that we need or other essential information that we need to gather and communicate to loved ones? Because I will give this example. Somebody I know, a work colleague, and we were close, and she went to my church. She passed away almost 20 years ago now. But there are things that she was very vocal about. She had a cancer diagnosis, very vocal about, that she did not want, but she could not bring herself to fill out all of these forms. And when she passed away, they were still on her desk unfilled out. And unfortunately, what happened was all the things she didn't want, because she was somebody who was single, those were the things that ended up happening to her property, to her last wishes, to her memorials and things like that. So I still, again, as you tell us about the additional information, really urge people not to put it off and to think it through, because even when you don't, you'll be, well, she's gone, but if she had been alive, she would have been disappointed, because she just couldn't bring herself to do it. And yet none of her wishes that she could not get on paper were followed.
Yes. And these things that we're talking about, the younger you start doing them, the easier they are to do and to keep updated. Because, if you start younger, if you start when you're 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, then you make a regular practice of updating it, but there's not very much to do when you're a little bit younger. But things like, first of all, along with the advance directive, is a will. Again, just shocking statistics that only 33% of Americans have a will. And of course, people often give the reason like, well, I don't have any assets, I don't need to leave a will. But even if you have very few assets, it's still important to let people know. I mean, if you have a car, what do you want done with your car? It's just like, there are things that we own, and that if we stop to think about it, we might think, well, I would want that person to have that. And again, even if there aren't many assets, then you just, ask a pastor, because they can tell you the stories of family arguments that have happened over the smallest things. And it sounds like maybe with your friend, some similar things happened. Along with your will, you'll appoint an executor. I should go back and say, you also want to appoint a durable power of attorney. That is a person that can be, now you're going back, these are more legal type things, but with your advance directive, you'll appoint a healthcare power of attorney. You can have the same person who handles, speaks for you with healthcare and speaks for you with finances. This person has the ability to pay your rent if you are incapacitated, things like that. So the durable power of attorney is very important to appoint. You create a will, you appoint an executor. That's the person who handles things after you've died. So I was the executor for my mother's will, and I just did all the things that she wanted done, because she made it clear she had laid all these things out. Another thing that is so important in our day and age that people often don't think about is passwords, organizing, sharing your passwords. I recommend password managers. I think they're great. Some people, my mom, back to her, she had all of hers recorded in a Word file and printed out and put them in in her filing cabinet. And so when I was going through things, I had everything I needed. And so it is so important to help people by having passwords organized. And then other essential information, biographical information, you know, medical history, personal history, titles and deeds, all of that, you know, just kind of day-to-day type stuff that we don't love thinking about, but that is absolutely essential to consider. And then the last thing is, and we'll talk more about this, but wishes for body disposition and end-of-life services. Those are also important to tell people about.
Well, and I would also say, like in the case of my friend that I was telling you about, a colleague, you know, the reason why there was this conflict, I mean, she didn't want to fill out all of these things, but on the one hand, when she went, her whole entire family were not Christians, and she was a Christian. So that was what I think was sad about it at the end, is the kinds of services, memorials, things that she had told me while she was, you know, struggling with bad news that she didn't have long to live, that she would never want, is exactly what happened. Because the people who, of course, legally have the right to come in, they're her relatives, and she was single. So those were all non-Christian folks. So these are just some of the things that are really difficult to think about, but you need to think about them. And then the other thing I want to ask you is, you know, you mentioned there's statistics that only about a third of Americans have a will, and, you know, there's also things like living wills and all this, but I want to find out what are some reasons people don't make a will. I will tell our listeners that I don't want to mention any specific sites. You know, it's not like we're sponsored by any sites to mention them, but there's a lot of legal sites now on the internet that are legitimate that can help you fill out a will for very inexpensively. So a lot of times people are like, well, I don't have a will because when I looked into it, if I'm going to use a Christian attorney, it's going to be hundreds and hundreds of dollars. You know, it might be $600, $1,000 to get a will. And I don't have that kind of money. But I just want to say a lot of the, especially if you don't have, you know, multiple businesses and homes and these kinds of things, you and you're younger, you can easily fill out a will. It's not very expensive. You know, just save to go buy one of these things online that actually are vetted by real attorneys from your state, and those will hold up. But I think for me, before you give me some of your reasons, I think that's one of the reasons that people give. It's the expense. But now with online, there's a lot of forms you can just download. And it's interesting, like, you know, in the current state I live in, wills are required to be notarized. But I know there's other states that there's no notarization required at all for it to be legal. So you just look into those things, but don't let like administrative details like that and cost stop you, because now with the internet, there's so many affordable options.
That is true, Melanie. And as you say, particularly for somebody who is young or just somebody who really, you know, if there aren't a lot of assets, then that can be a great way to go. If there are, it's also good to know that most estate attorneys really offer kind of a package to get all of these things done, your advance directive, your durable power of attorney, your will, your executor. They offer that kind of as a loss leader. So it's worth looking into with some local attorneys to see how much it would cost. I have been told by estate attorneys that sometimes when there are more assets involved, that it ends up costing people on one end or the other. And so it may cost people a little bit to pay a lawyer to do these things, to get a well-organized will and estate package, but it will actually benefit the heirs later in just in the ease of process and there not being financial issues that come up. So, you know, I am the farthest thing from an estate attorney or, you know, somebody who understands all of the complexities of that. That is why that we do often recommend that people at least talk to a lawyer, at least make an early appointment with a lawyer. Sometimes they can do simple things. Also, legal aid in many states will help people get a simple will executed. So that's another option. But as you say, I do think cost, I think it's, you know, back to the whole thing with having this conversation. Many of us just don't want to think about it. I think another reason people don't do it is that there are decisions to be made, and it's hard to make some of these decisions. And so for that reason, we procrastinate. And I think that we just don't think about the outcome, about what can happen, as with your friend and as with many families, where there can be real division if we don't make the effort to do these things. So it is a hard task. And I guess the statistics speak to that, but such an important one.
And I really urge, it might seem odd to some people, and maybe we don't have a lot of younger people listening to this podcast, but you know, you could pass it on to your adult children, but it might seem odd to them. They may be like, I'm 26. Why do I need a will or whatever, you know, and they're out working on their own. And I would just say to something you said earlier is, because who are you going to leave certain things to? In other words, the parent might not come in and realize you've collected, I don't know, some kind of collectible card thing, or, and then they're like, I can't deal with these person's baseball cards, and they just donate them to Goodwill. And so a lot of times if that, you can see that happening. If you go to Goodwill and you're like, whoa, this thing is worth so much money. Why in the world? It's because your loved one was so overwhelmed and or so sad that they didn't want to deal with it. And they just said, let's just box this all up and either throw it away or give it to Goodwill. And that's why you see those programs where someone comes across a painting or a vase or something at their local thrift store. And it was just like, oh, this thing is worth $10,000. It's like, what? But it's because these kinds of things happen and you don't donate. But you know what? All of your buddies knew how much those cards were made, or your girlfriends knew that you collected designer handbags or whatever it is. I'm not saying all Christians do that, but there are things that people collect. The other persons that are in charge of cataloging your things after you pass don't even know about. And so, you know, I'm sure you've heard stories too, that people went down to the local thrift store and found some huge collection of something. That's exactly what happened. No one gave a direction of what to do with it.
That is so true. Those are great examples, Melanie, to get all of us thinking like, oh yeah. And if you take the trouble to have a collection, or just even any of your valued possessions, even if they're not worth anything monetarily, if you just think about like, oh, you know, how would I feel if that were given away to Goodwill? That might help you think through some of these things.
And like you said, it might not be something like that, but it could be something like, I know there are a lot of people who keep journals of things, and, you know, they'll be like, oh, let's just throw these out. But that you might have a spiritual mentor or somebody who you mentored that would have loved to have your, you know, spiritual thoughts on things. So, you know, that's why it's so important to think through things that mean something to you. It might not be a collection, it might be something else, but if it's something that has meaning, and then also people who are close to you, if it was something like this one thing, I would like to give it to them because they're going to remember me by that thing. So that's good to think through it. Now, I just want to ask you also about how we deal with, you mentioned earlier, body dispositions and end-of-life services. I will say at the Christian Research Institute, we feel very strongly that, and it is a controversial topic because not all Christians agree, but our position is that cremation is unbiblical. And so I will make sure that we link in why we believe in not cremating the body, because that is an issue. So if maybe that's your conviction not to be cremated, how are you going to handle that if your loved ones or your spouse thought, oh, I just assume I would cremate them? That'd be one thing. But also end-of-life services. And it's not morbid. Well, some people might think it's morbid, but I gave some thought to it. I mean, I had decided a while back, I want to plan my own service. I don't have any health problems, nothing's happening, but I don't know. I might walk out in the street and get hit by a bus. So a few years ago, I asked a pastor friend, if I were to die in the next 10 years, would he do my service? I already asked that. And I have a whole list of songs that I want sung at my service and people I want, musicians I want there. So that might seem kind of weird, but honestly, again, in the example of my friend, I know she likes certain songs. Now, we did do a memorial service for her that her family, I don't know that they were present because they're from a different state, at our own church. So I picked those songs that she liked and knew about, and she did have unbelieving friends that came to this service, but you know, why have your family member pick that for you when you already know what your favorite hymns are that you hope would be sung when you passed away?
Yeah, absolutely, Melanie. It is such a gift. I mean, one of the first questions that we are going to be asked after, you know, the phone call that I've gotten three times now for my father, my mother, and my aunt is, what should be done with her body? And if you have made those funeral, the arrangements with the funeral home in advance, then that just, it's just so much easier rather than a person having to go and, in the case of burial, buy a plot, find the funeral home, figure all of that out. When you get that phone call that your loved one has died, it's not an easy time to be making any kind of decision. And so, you know, we've heard the horror stories about funeral homes and selling you the most expensive coffin. And I think that that's more a thing of the past because there is a Funeral Consumers Alliance that just, you know, provides for a lot of rights for people in this situation. And so, you know, for the most part, that is not something that most funeral homes are trying to do. But wherever you can make decisions in advance, and, you know, not that necessarily have to pick out the coffin, but say, like I said, I want a pine box. It was good enough for Eugene Peterson. It's good enough for me. Like simple, it's going in the ground, just where you can at least give a description of, please just choose the least expensive one. It doesn't matter. Or maybe you want the most expensive one, whatever is your choice. But also where you can pay for that in advance, that is another very helpful thing. Burial and funerals can be very, very expensive. So that's something to know. And wherever that is a possibility and practical, like, you know, you're not going to be moving from the place you currently live, you're going to live there forever, that's a really helpful thing. Same with end of life services. What you've done is so helpful. And I think that's something, like, all of us, when we go to funerals, we probably are thinking like, oh, I don't want a funeral like this. Like, I've been to a few that are just, they're just very depressing, but, you know, they're also, there's no hope of the gospel. And so,
but also, it doesn't seem like the people conducting the service, like the minister, even knew this person.
Yes, that is so true. And, you know, and I have to say, like, my pastor did my father's service. He had never met my father, but he asked for stories about my father, and he preached the most beautiful sermon that really incorporated who my dad was into, you know, his sermon. And then he preached the gospel. And so, you know, but again, it's hard. That is not an easy thing to do. So great kudos to my pastor for doing that. But that's a hard thing to do. So the more you can express your wishes, who you would want to speak, as you did, like musicians, hymns, many churches, some churches have, you can ask your particular church if they have some kind of booklet or form that you can fill out. My mother did, and she had done that, and it was filed with the church. So when she died, her priest called me and said, you know, I have the information of what she wanted for her funeral. Oh, so helpful. I didn't have to choose what hymns my mother would want in the midst of my grief.
I do think that that is really helpful, and things that, you know, we don't necessarily think of. And also, when you're talking about plots and all this kind of thing, you know, sometimes because you don't think about it, you might not talk to your own spouse. Maybe there is a expectation, should we be buried where we were from versus are we going to be buried, you know, where we live now, which none of our kids ever plan to come back to XYZ place, or, you know, whatever. Those are all kinds of issues that need to be thought through that we don't always think through. And something else that I saw a few years ago, and it's made me think, was I saw this whole documentary on green burial. So, you know, just being buried in a the ground in a shroud, like, oh, gee, like they used to do in ancient times. There are a few places that are sanctioned for that. But, you know, those are the kinds of things you have to think about. Like you said, is it the most expensive box? Is it going to be something simple? Did you want a huge gravestone? What is going to be on that gravestone? Are you going to decide? Are you going to have your loved ones decide? All those kinds of things need to be thought through. Well, finally, though, I would just like to ask you, what could motivate us that we need to leave this practical legacy for loved ones? Because like we said, it's not something we think about unless someone maybe is dying or has a terminal illness. But why should healthy and young people and people of all ages that are not expecting to wake up today and pass away, which sometimes when there's big tragedies in this country, it's like, I'm sure those people didn't wake up that day on their way to the airport or wherever else it was and expect that they would pass. So what should motivate us to think through what it means to leave a practical legacy for our family and loved ones?
Well, I would hope, you know, and for anyone who has made it to the end of this conversation, you will be with us on this. But I would hope that understanding the benefit to our loved ones would really help us. So, you know, let's do what the Puritans said. Think about our dying from time to time and of the circumstances which attend death. And so if we just use our imagination for a minute and we use the proverbial hit by a bus scenario where, you know, let's do it together so we make it a little less frightening. We don't have to do it alone. We're out walking, touring Rome. I almost got hit by a bus in Rome. We're hit by the bus and we're killed instantly. Immediately, we are in the arms of Jesus. We are looking on his face and we are consumed by God's glory. We are good. But now let's imagine our families. They are shocked. They are grieved. If, for instance, we were in a coma instead of killed instantly, they're having to make decisions about end-of-life measures. But they know, I can head to the filing cabinet. I can head to the safe. I will find a binder there. I will find files there that tell me exactly what to do. When the police call them to say, what about the body? We know, call this funeral home. We call the pastor. They know to call the pastor. The pastor knows that we wanted the gospel preached at our funeral. The pastor knows what hymns we wanted sung. And it's time to read the will. And the executor knows where the will is and knows why things are distributed the way they are, because she's talked to us and she knows our wishes. And so just think about that scenario for our families. Yes, they are grieving. They are sad. But what they are not doing is arguing or feeling incredible burdens of not knowing what we wanted or having doubts or uncertainties. They have some peace that we have helped to give them by providing all of this information and help for them. I think when we think through it that way, why wouldn't we want to offer that kind of peace to our loved ones?
And as a PS to her earlier comments about passwords, I'd say in the days of social media, even people who are boomers have social media. So make sure that you have given all those passwords to your loved ones, because do they want to keep your account open? Do they want to shut it down? I had a friend whose husband died suddenly, and actually he was a colleague, and she has elected all these, it's been more than 10 or 15 years now that he passed, to keep a social media account open to remember him every time it's his birthday or things like that. So don't forget about social media. Well, finally, I have a quick question, but I don't want to say it's a light question because it is part of this conversation, but it's a rapid fire question for Elizabeth, because this is a question people have. And that is, you've been invited to memorial service. What do you wear? Should you be wearing black and be OG, or can you wear other colors?
Yeah. Oh man, that's definitely up for discussion in this day and time. So I can only answer with what I would do. I will not say, I'm thinking about the funerals I've been to recently, because, you know, I live in Florida and it's very hot in Florida for some of these summer funerals. So I will wear something that has black in it if it is not completely black. So I still am the traditionalist and I still am going to represent mourning by wearing black. And the fact that I'm grieving, it's an outward symbol of something inward of grief. So that's how I see it. Are you going to answer the question, Melanie?
Well, I think when I do go to funerals recently in the past year or so, I just see all different kinds of things, even for people that are older than me. They're not wearing black, but I don't know. I guess I feel traditional about that. And I do. And I know that a lot of funerals these days are focused on, you know, we can rejoice with them because they're in the presence of Christ. But I tend to wear black. I do. I do have some things even for the summer that I can get on that are black. I don't even wear prints. I tend to go solid, but I don't think that's required anymore, but I thought I'd ask because you probably encountered this question. Well, thank you, Elizabeth, for helping us think through a difficult topic. And thanks for being on the Postmodern Realities podcast again.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 397 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. We're headed to episode 400, and after 8 years, that will be a huge milestone for us. Today's guest was Elizabeth Reynolds Turnage, and she has written an online feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and her article is called Understanding Medicalized Dying and Preparing for Incapacitation or Death. You can read Elizabeth's article completely free without a paywall at our website, equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.